and also because we have an author with us who's written a book called Banjo Grease. His name is Dennis Must. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, John.
Tell me, first off, where are you visiting us from?
I'm from Boston, a town north of Boston called Swampscott, about 20 miles north near a town that your listeners might know as Marblehead, that area.
And have you been there for a long, long time? Or?
Probably about 10, 15 years. Lived in New York City for a number of years. Originally come from western Pennsylvania, a small mining town there, where most of these stories find their source.
That is the next question I was about to ask, and that is to... Now, what I've read of the stories, most of them seem to take place like in the 40s.
They are. They take place in the 40s, and and the reason for that is that's when I grew up. I was born in 1934.
Are you serious?
Yes.
How do you do it? How old would you say this guy is if you just looked at him? 50, maybe. So you were born in 1934.
1934.
That means you're 60.
67.
Well, I'm completely blown away because I'm looking at this picture of you that came with the book, and I'm thinking, well, interesting trick this guy has pulled off writing about a generation earlier than his, but it is actually the time you were growing up.
Yes, John, there's an interesting story that goes with that. Is when the publisher, Donald Ellis, accepted these stories, he sent them off to a new editor of his. And she did her work and called me and said, give me a call. Let's talk about the work that I've done. And her first question was, I like these stories, Mr. Must. The scatological aspects of them bother me a little bit. But the thing that really bothers me is, why don't you write about a time that you know?
That's what blew me. So, okay, I'm not the only one to fall into that trap.
Right.
It's quite amazing. Well, I would say the one thing that also struck me about it is that, aside from that confusion, how could you be writing with such intimate knowledge about an era in which you weren't actually living? I was looking at your picture thinking that you were more my age and that you know, I wasn't even born in time. Well, 46 is when I was born, but I wouldn't have remembered that era with that kind of vividness, with detail and all. But you obviously have it firsthand. The other thing that I'm thinking about is that the literature that describes that time, for the most part, what I've read anyway, is nowhere nearly so explicit in terms of its graphic nature, and the scatological is that way you used the term.
And I write what I know, John, to discover what I don't know. That's what drives me.
That's well said.
And what I discovered when this book was finished, these stories sort of, I'd been a playwright off Broadway for a number of years, and it came time for me to raise a family and make some serious money, and I left, put all the writing behind. And I thought that I had my time in the proverbial sun. And I was very difficult not to return to writing, but I was afraid that if I did, that I'd lose my family. So for a good 15, 20 years, I put blinders on and wore a business suit and made a good living and raised a family.
What kind of business were you
in? I was ultimately owned a corporate real estate company in Boston.
Really? Made lots of money.
Yes. It was a wonderful time, John.
Great.
And the only good part about it was the money.
But it enabled you to be able to ultimately
absolutely
retire.
And it's enabling me to do what I am now, to rent a car and come and accept your gracious offering to be here today.
You've already done your book signing last night, I think.
Yes.
So we're lucky to get you today.
Yes, it was done at Round Rock, and there are a number of copies of Banjo Grease there that have been, I have my signature on and are available.
You see, it strikes me that, you know, one of the I'm glad I did finish the story, the title story, this morning, because one of the common questions, I don't always read the books, you know, but I've been liking yours, and so I've been reading them, and I would say, where'd you come up with the title Banjo Grease? And tell us about how that fits in. Do you guys sit in the back know the answer to this? Yeah. So that would be, oh my goodness, we can't tell that story.
No, we can. We can tell it. Trust me.
You think we can?
Oh, yes. We can tell it with the certain veils over it.
Okay.
Over lace over it.
Tell us. How'd you come up with that title?
Banjo Grease comes, the title comes from the story of the same name. Mm-hmm. And it is a risque story that I couldn't tell on this air here. But what fascinated me as a young man when I heard that, as a boy actually, when that story was told, was there was a certain surrealistic, absurd quality about pairing these two, Banjo Grease.
Now, this was actually told to you?
That story was told to me. Told
by your uncle?
A distant uncle, yes. And when we asked the question, he said, well, what was that was used? And he said, Banjo Grease, mm-hmm. as if everybody should know. And for me, it's a metaphor that captures the surrealistic, absurd quality of these stories, mm-hmm. Sort of laughing at life. This is our lot in life. Enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You don't have many other choices if you don't. Recently, a reviewer wrote and asked, I'm working on a review, but tell me what Banjo Grease means. And I said I didn't know. I always thought it was a non sequitur. Well, she did some research and discovered that it was a term used by the African-American community in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
To describe a male member. And the way she approached this whole review is that she sees it, the Banjo Grease, as a metaphor for expected pleasures, mm-hmm. even deserved pleasures, that often go awry. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was quite wonderful.
That's great. But this word, the terminology Banjo Grease, was actually in that story that you heard from your uncle.
Yes, yes.
Had you ever known what it really was?
Never, mm-hmm. never. And when it just had it had just a wonderful poetic quality about it, mm-hmm. that just sort of hung there all those years.
Mm-hmm. There must be something real that's called Banjo Grease.
Well, as this etymologist indicated, that mm-hmm. the banjo at the time was another slang word for the male member.
Mm-hmm.
And
we can go on and reveal that the hysterical part of this story, it's very, very funny. Essentially, it's used as a lubricant for sexual purposes.
That's right.
And they wind up not getting the Vaseline, but something that is more like Bengay, I guess.
That's interesting, and exactly what the reviewer said. Is it Bengay? And I thought, well, if you'd said Bengay, nobody would have laughed,
mm-hmm.
because it had been boorish.
Right. But Banjo Grease.
Banjo Grease.
Right. All right, let's get busy and hear one of these stories. You've got one picked out that you said you think you can read.
This story is called Cloth. I've never undressed for my wife. Not once have I seen her step out of the bathtub, climb into a bathing suit, or crawl into our bed unclothed. I can draw her body with my hands, every dimple, mole, collapse, and bulge. In the dark, I see by touch. I know the train of her body better than I do my own. Place me in a room absent light, permit me to touch the faces of five women. Unerringly, I'd pick Gabrielle's. My own face among four others, I'd fail the test. It was never her choice. I've heard some men complain their wives have never appeared before them nude. Gabrielle would express no such reserve. The conditions are mine. Even on our wedding night, I insisted her body be absent illumination. My hands store that memory. Why? Father's woman danced nude. I saw her only unclothed and in the turkey trot, always after everybody had gone to bed. My brother James and I would be awakened by a shrill voice trailing back and forth in the upstairs hallway. Stark naked, she would be twirling and gesturing at her closed bedroom door, spitting out Father's name. At a tabernacle church in our neighborhood, I'd witness women dancing in the aisles and speaking in tongues, as if in a trance, collapse exhausted onto the floor and shiver paroxysmally. Father's woman danced like that too. But hers was more a dance of curse, vituperating him who lay awake on the other side of the bedroom door. She'd dip and stride, jump and twirl, point at the hallway light and cry, "You bastard, tonight I will jump off cement dam. None of you believe it, but I will show each of you." Young James would begin crying. I'd tell him to be quiet and that if she tried to leave the house, would follow her. "She's got to jig it out of her system," I say. "It's like the holy rollers strip the willow. They foam at the mouth and collapse. She will too, but back in Father's bed. Nothing's going to happen. Now stop your damn bawling." Mother lived in the same house too, just the four of us. But she never high-kicked, and I suspect Father never saw her naked either. Not that he didn't want to. He loved women, all kinds of women. A light turned on inside of him when the subject was raised, but not with Mother. Profoundly religious and clothed tight to her cervix and far below her knees, black laced matron's heels, hair in a netted bun, pulled severely off her forehead and no makeup, face white as the flour she'd crank through her sifter daily. Mother'd chastise Father, James and me, for wandering through the house in a state of undress. "It's not proper," she'd cry, running to fetch a shirt or a pair of trousers. James and I figured when we'd die, Jesus would greet us in a suit and tie. That's why they'd bury us so, too. The naked go only to hell. Mother wasn't doing the hysteria shuffle at 2 a.m. It was Leanne Dougherty. Curiously enough, it was the first time James or I ever saw a naked woman. There had been pornographic depictions of women in the literature down at the local gas station, artist's renditions on men's room walls, but Leanne caterwauling back and forth in the hallway was our introduction to how the opposite sex actually looked indecently exposed. It wasn't pretty. Threatening suicide off the cement dam that lay a mile up our road, a 150-foot concrete wall that once held back the mighty Neshannock River. But decades earlier, the Army Corps of Engineers had diverted the river, and the cement dam now sat out there incongruously at the Hebron countryside, a barrier towering up inside a gorge. Wasn't a year went by that one or two citizens didn't take their life by leaping off into the waterless rubble below. Townspeople began to believe it held persuasive powers, the whole terrain about the land, that if you ventured anywhere near, say even a half mile, its elegiac pull would draw you to the dam and certain death. Even the utterance of the name frightened the youth of Hebron. Satan paled in power. Leanne thrust its spell into us over her gavotte, her swooping against the stained and unraveling wallpaper, darting like a moth against the door to our room, her sobbing an ineluctable grief. For what James nor I were ever certain. Her raw anger directed at Father, and even it appeared at God. Why had either of them violated her so? The coda to her lament? You'll see. The whole damn bunch of you will see. I'm off to cement dam. But she never went. Over time, Leanne would wind down, her sobbing would grow less impassioned, her invectives against the closed door of Father's room fewer, until finally, folding into a woman ball, she rolled into a corner, unmoving, no more wails, screeches, imprecations, or threats. Shortly, Father's door opened. "It's time to come to bed, dear." Bending low to grasp Leanne's hand, together they'd glide back into the dark, shutting their door softly. Bright the next morning, Mother would appear, her house dress buttoned to her sternum and skirting her calves, a pair of sheer white anklets and string lace ward shoes, wearing a gossamer hairnet. Leanne's hair fell to the swale in her back, barely touching her buttocks. James and I lie frigid in our bed following such performances, listening for any noise we might decipher, grateful for the peace, grateful that the dance would not erupt for another month, grateful that we didn't have to follow her to cement dam. We'd offer a prayer, whispering it between ourselves. "Thank you, God. Leanne has flown our house once again. And could you keep her away longer next time?" Perhaps if we'd been youngsters at the time of the dithyram, say 5 or 6 years old, they wouldn't have affected us as they did much later. Leanne's flings, however provocative, it was a fact that she associated them with death, that queered our vicarious pleasure. Sex, certainly, her out there springing her body off the mahogany woodwork hallway in the flickering overhead light, the slapping of her bare feet onto the dark shellac floors, her wailing and moaning, a larger-than-life shadow graph billowing across the fleur-de-lis wallpaper, hair moving rope-like about her naked torso, lashing and caressing it, a salt and pepper hauser, the fleshy mouth out of which lamentation shaped into mournful entreaties to God and Father, as if a plunge of 150 feet into Abraham's waterless bosom could be the only succor up to the task. If this was sex, we were aroused and stricken by it. Father related to both women with characteristic equanimity, however, until the day Leanne became mother. The early morning dance event occurred with such predictable frequency for 2 years that eventually neither James nor I would leap out of bed at their onset. We'd lie listening to Leanne shrieking and body slump, awaiting Father's soothing voice, cajoling her back into their bed, caressing the door shut. Our prayers of relief had grown perfunctory. We were being lulled into the belief that Leanne would never carry out the cement dam threat. Then James and I found employment for a commissary at a nearby AA ballpark. 3 summer nights a week with a doubleheader on Saturday, several hundred Hebron citizens would pay to watch baseball. James worked the stands with a hot dog dispenser while I managed the refreshment booth. One August evening, I was icing vendor soda buckets when Father appeared at the mittens gate, summoning me out to the parking lot. "Seems you better get home, Wesley." "Why?" "It's your mother." "What's wrong with her?" "Well, nothing yet, but I just think you should stick around the house." "I don't understand. What's wrong?" "Like I said, nothing's wrong, yet I don't like the way she's acting." "Leanne, Dad?" He shook his head. "She ain't shown for some time. Now your mother's begun talking just like her. I don't like it." "Where are you going?" I asked. "Out," he said. "You go on home now and be the man. You're old enough." He climbed into his 36 Dodge sedan and drove off, an ominous cloud of garbled dust in his trail. I took off right behind him on my bicycle. When I entered the house, I called out her name. "Ma?" I hollered. "Ma, where are you?" No answer. "Well, maybe she's Leanne upstairs, fandangoing through our empty bedrooms. Is that what he meant? Or perhaps she was balled up like tumbleweed in the corner of our hallway, and he couldn't get her to stand up to go back into the bedroom. He spoke about my being a man now. It's what men do, grab their Leannes by the arms when they get this way and lead them back into the confines of the dark bedroom they share. In the morning, the exit is the real people we know, the people who don't dance to frighten. Upstairs, I could smell the cologne Father sprinkled on his body, like he always did when he went out of an evening. I saw the imprint of a body on the counterpane in the room, perhaps Leanne's, though Mother's string shoes sat neatly paired at the foot of the bed. "Mother?" The sound ricocheted through the half-light bungalow. The only noise, our refrigerator's dull drone. The cellar, perhaps. Hanging up clothes in the lines strung overhead. She's ironing down there and didn't hear me. But as I ran downstairs and entered the kitchen, I froze. Did I really want to go down there? Bad things always happen in basements, rarely in one's living or dining room. The heinous acts always occur in that raw, undomesticated chamber of the house. "Mother, are you down there?" Father's face, why had he alerted me? What had she done, causing him to shift this time and ever before? At the base of the cellar steps sat a two-burner cast iron grill on cement blocks. It was attached to the main gas feed by a terracotta red rubber hose. Each summer, Mother placed large blue porcelain kettles filled with neatly packed, picked tomatoes, newly picked tomatoes on its starfish burners. For hours, the fruit would simmer into a sauce she'd jar and store for winter meals, the red pulp steaming, bubbling, lava-like, popping and spitting red juice onto the whitewashed cellar walls, both porcelain cocks open wide. She sat limp on a metal stool before the unlit stove, her head and arms buried beneath a chrysanthemum print washing machine cozy. A salmon-colored chemise stopped at her knees. Bare legs and feet dangled at the sides of the stool. Alongside lay a crumpled "Till Death Do Us Part" note, addressed to father and signed by mother's closest friend. Caterwauling like Cleanne, I gathered in my arms and carried her out of the cellar, begging that she come alive. Her hair fell loose, brushing against my body each step I took. She felt cold. I cursed my departed father, cursed God, and begged that she not leave me alone. Gone to Cement Dam in James in my absence. And now I bore her body through the light dying house, wailing, but nobody heard. I laid her on the sofa, thrust each of the windows open to the evening air, then pumped her chest as if I lifted her out of a pond, calling her to make a sound, any sound, even if she'd speak in tongues. Oh God, it would be sufficient. Please don't leave us. Drumming her chest, her small frame bouncing ludicrously up and down in the mohair sofa cushions like a cloth doll. Father's woman, the Lord will meet us in the hereafter dressed like a mannequin woman. The I will wear my faux pearl button chemise with black patent leather shoes and purse with a silver clasp woman. No Leanne's allowed in the house of the Lord. But I didn't want to be in the house of the Lord. My semi-nude head water, the rise out of which I'd coiled 15 years earlier, I willed to pull in the air, beat on her as they once beat on me and James, slapped us up against the backside hard before we bawled, "Christ, mother, come alive, God damn it, come alive." And in my mind, I saw myself reaching into her balled-up soul, untangling her arms and dancing her to the surface, watching her awake to gulp breath, suck the Hebron night air out of the gullies of all the cement dams of this world, God's fear and trembling threshers, and ever so fragile, a smile eddied her purple rose lips, me atop her like I'd ridden my ghost across the mess of time. "What did you do that for?" she asked, for which I had no answer.
We have a guest with us today, Dennis Must, who's the author of a collection of stories called Banjo Grease, and that, I assume, is the last one in the book, from the way it looked like.
No, it's not. There's
close to it.
There's a send-up after that called O Josephine.
So that one was called Cloth?
Yes, Cloth.
Tell us how much of real life that story has in it, if any.
The facts are all there.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry is a kind of a lying, and so one never knows. Nabokov says that we don't think in words, but we think in shadows of words. When I write, I attempt to push myself back into those periods of that is the subject of what I'm writing about. And I tend to think in terms of images. I'll remember sitting across from you 10 years hence, not today, but I'll remember the color of sweater and the shirt that you wore. And so it's the attempt to capture those shadows that I, to re-experience what occurred then.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if my father read that, he would laugh, although he's no longer alive.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's a, you always took life too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
My mother would have read that and wouldn't have understood, except that she would certainly have understood the act, which was real.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty close, I think, John. Pretty close.
All right. At the beginning of the book, it's got stories about, I mean, Wesley is definitely, we assume.
He's the one who ties us all together. This, mm-hmm. The way I like to think about it, John, is they are coming of age in many respects, mm-hmm. but it's not one.
He's probably about 15.
That's right. That's right. And there are a few other stories in there. There's one that he's It's called Big Whitey when he's 19, 20, 21 years old, mm-hmm. when he's in New York City.
Right.
Escape from the small town, the gravity of the small town.
Right.
But I see it as like each one of these stories, there's a ration of innocence that's lost.
Mm-hmm.
The payment for, okay, you've gotten the story, now give me the payment.
Right.
And that's the innocence. And sort of like locks of body of water going up to either higher or lower body of water.
Mm-hmm.
In that story, Banjo Grease, mm-hmm. there's the kid talks about, Wesley talks about running off to see this aunt and uncle who live in the back of a cow pasture that's turned into a drive-in
mm-hmm.
in Ohio, down in dirty rural Ohio area. And they live in this little one-room trailer all year round. But to him, that was like going, it was almost as if that aunt and uncle were David O. Selznick. I mean, to go there and every night and see a 20 or 30-foot James Cagney dancing across his phosphorescent screen in a cow pasture, nonetheless,
mm-hmm.
night after night, and having access to concessions, and then the next day he and his uncle going out and picking up all of the things that people left behind, not the least of it, which were empty popcorn boxes and, you know, soda bottles.
And but sexually related
yes,
artifacts.
Exactly, dependent on who was playing that night.
Mm-hmm.
But
which adds another element of tremendous humor. These stories can be yes, very, very funny.
Yes, but it's a kind of humor. It's a real working class humor.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all that sophisticated. And the thing that I wanted to say on that subject a moment ago about going through these locks, I look back upon that aunt and uncle now from this vantage point as sad. Those souls were, that was a rather pathetic existence that they lived.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he talks about in the wintertime, when the boy leaves, the boy says, well, the mother wants, the aunt wants the boy to go because the boy and her husband are fishing and they're doing too many things that she'd prefer that they didn't do. And he says, well, where are you going? I don't know. And he says, well, you know, do you find any good fishing holes, write me. Well, what about Aunt Min? What she can, well, she'll, you know, she knows how to get through the winter, you know, sit here and play solitaire and keep her hair up in curlers and paint her toenails and her nails.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't do that all the time, you know. But she's my woman. I got to stay here. So, you know, it's that capturing those shadows of childhood
mm-hmm.
that are both real and fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And then from this vantage point, where most everything is real, and there's very little fiction
mm-hmm.
when you get, you know, upper later in years.
Right. Well, I think what is fascinating about reading stories such as these, or here, I'll just give you an example. The last one you read, the cloth story, it's so full. I mean, you experience it not just in terms of the storyline, but in your writing, especially because of the richness of metaphor. You're constantly describing details of little things, like the tomato thing, the cooking
right.
and all that stuff.
Spitting against the wall.
Right. And talking about, well, the cellar, going to the cellar and thinking what goes, I actually did grow up in Ohio till I was 8. And I have still a scar. It's a little bitty one. I can't remember which finger it's on, where a Clorox bottle fell down in the cellar and cut my little finger. It's, I don't know where it is. Yeah, there it is. Still a little scar. But that's where my father poisoned my dog. You know, so all of these things come up that are personal to the individual reader,
yes,
which are not at all what the author is intending.
Right.
But somehow you, just as you are discovering for yourself things about yourself while right. you write these stories, I think the reader, that's why we read,
right.
is to have the experience of, Wow. Right. It's a different, and this is, these are very different stories from any I've read before. I can't think of analogies to this kind of writing. Can you?
No, I can't. I can't.
They're pithy. They're very, 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 and also, you don't help us very much with what's going on. Several times I had to, now what happened here? Okay, well, he doesn't say he got off the bus. He doesn't say where he got off or anything. Right. Like you're on the bus and you're talking about where is the drive-in, and they say it's closed. Different voices chime in. The next thing you know, you're walking.
Right.
So it's like, you know, a lot of it you have to just sort of add to the story yourself, or assume, or think more about what's going on, because they're very tersely written.
Right. I'm working with an editor now on a novel that's about finished.
A novel?
Yeah.
Very good. Will Wesley be in this novel or?
Yes, he will, actually.
So the same subject matter.
Same subject matter. Two brothers, actually.
James.
That's right. My brother died at a reasonably early age.
What was his name?
James. Mm-hmm.
Were you ever called Wesley for any reason?
No.
No. How'd you come up with that name?
He was a character that I was fascinated with in my early youth. The son of friends of my family who had one ear. Mm. And that fascinated me like banjo grease did. Mm-hmm. And he had also a ethereal quality about him. You know.
Now that sounds very much like a character in one of the stories.
There is. It's a story called Horse. Mm-hmm. That was based on, that I used that character. Not that character, but used part of him. Mm-hmm. The fact that he had the one ear. Mm-hmm. And molded him with somebody else. Mm-hmm. But
he was sort of autistic or something? What would you say his condition?
The guy in that story?
Yeah. I mean, he had all these columns and
it
letters.
It was strange. That was based, it was very close to the autobiographical bone, all these stories. And I just remember that there are people that share pieces of you, older folks that share pieces of who they are with you, mm-hmm. if they trust you, mm-hmm. and if they're a little different and they think you're a little different. Mm-hmm. And I had lots of aunts and uncles, but this aunt took me and showed me this friend of hers in the woods that lived next door, who was a very strange man and obviously was mentally handicapped, but an idiot savant, mm-hmm. you know, that could repeat pages and pages of history. But there was something about this. Johnny literally carried these composition books around. And when she saw that I was, you know, that there was some atavistic thing going between her and me, and I've mm-hmm. always, I think I was 7 or 8 years old at the time, come, Denny, I want to show you my friend here. And we went out in the woods, almost like a Truman Capote thing in a way. Mm-hmm. And this guy comes down and tapping, is always tapping his feet, mm-hmm. you know, tapping. And then once he understood that it was okay, that she was letting him know by her body language that it was okay to talk to this young boy, then he sat down and he said, okay, I'm going to show you my journals. Mm-hmm. And this is very special, but you can write in these. And he opened up these composition books, and just page after page of these random numbers. Mm-hmm. And okay, now I've saved a page for you, and you begin to write. And I wrote like 3, 6, 7, 8. Oh, no, that you can't. There's an order to that. Here, this is how. Mm-hmm. And when it was all done, he literally said to me, I said, I'm going back, and we've talked about, I didn't know anything about history, and I still don't, but we're talking about some Southern general. And I said, I'm going back and tell my grade school class about how much you know about him. And he said, it's been wonderful to be with you today. I enjoy spending time with a scholar. And we're scholars, he said. I said, oh, yes. And then he turned to me with that ear missing, you know. It was sort of like a buttoneer that mm-hmm. gone inside and turned and sort of shined it on me.
You make it sound the way you describe it in the story as if it were an eye, like a
yes.
third eye.
It was like a third eye. It was mm-hmm. a sort of, well, you're part of this whole other kind of awareness here.
Deeper, you know? Knowledge of some sort.
Something.
Atavistic or
yes,
whatever you say.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I think that, like you said about, you know, what was it that you said that Nabokov said that we don't think that in words, but shadows
of words. We don't think
shadows
in terms
of
words. We think in terms of shadows of words.
Mm-hmm. Now, this may not be a good analogy, but it's like behind the story, there's another story.
Yes.
There's the one that we can awaken to yes. by intimation, implication.
Right. Or hopefully behind my story is your story.
That's what I suggested before.
Right.
And I think that's a good writer manages to leave enough to the imagination
right.
of the reader to where it's like we make right. up our own story by analogy.
Right.
And this is a period that, I mean, I was alive in that era, but I don't remember it, as I said before. But reading your stories, it's like, oh, yeah, that's mm-hmm. real. You have, mm-hmm. even though we don't know what those artifacts are, or mm-hmm. maybe we saw them, you know, somehow in a movie, but they weren't really emphasized mm-hmm. or anything. You have things like a mangle.
Yes,
a mangle. What the hell is a mangle? And so I looked it up and, oh, tell us what a mangle is.
Well, mangle is, you know, is that normally we're called Westinghouse or GE mangles, and a mm-hmm. woman, then a woman, would sit down in front of it in a chair, a dinette chair or whatever, and mangle bed sheets, straight work. And actually what it was like you'd go into a cleaner and you see somebody putting a presser down, a mechanical presser down on a shirt or that, and there'd be steam coming from it. That's exactly what would happen, but it would happen by knee operation, sort of under this, like this desk module, and this head would come down that was heated and padded, and it would come down on a rolling pad, and you'd make certain to put the sheet to go in there straight, and out would come. And of course, at that point, all the sheets had to be, after they were washed, they had to be ironed. And so Monday was washing day, and Tuesday was mangling day. Mm-hmm. And one wonderful thing about that was is that you'd sit there in the wintertime, and the heat would come off it, and it had its own pleasure.
Mm-hmm. See, that's what I mean, these little artifacts. Now, you don't tell nearly that much in the story
no.
that I read. You just refer to what was there, and it was a Westinghouse mangle.
Right, right.
But there you go. Now, see, that's another story,
mm-hmm.
or a part of another story.
Right.
And those little details and the experience of emotions related to those details, which you just described so well, are what I think makes the book really rich. Mm-hmm. It almost reads as if it is a novel, except that it's not. You know, it's just yeah, called different stories
right,
instead.
But they are interconnected, right? Mm-hmm.
A mangle. Let's see what else. You have. There was an anti-macassar or moccasar.
Yes.
Do you guys in the back know what an anti-macassar?
Anti-macassar.
Mm-hmm.
And those were. There must be folks in your listening audience that are laughing now because they remember them seeing them probably on their grandmother's. Sofas and mm-hmm. Overstuffed chairs, lace doilies mm-hmm. that were over the back of the chair, really, so that the Vitalis or
which
Vaseline
we all
hair
use
tonic
back in
or whatever
yeah.
wouldn't stain the sofa,
mm-hmm.
and those would be washed and ironed too.
Right.
But every sofa had them, mm-hmm. as did the. Overstuffed chairs, antimacassars.
Antimacassar.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know how I got to pronouncing that in my own funny way. That's another thing that's funny about words that you don't look up, but you just mm-hmm. read. And, you know, yeah, hyperbole or whatever it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another aspect of that era. Everybody used something on their hair, and it was usually greasy as hell.
Yes. Yes.
And that stayed the case until, I guess, the Beatles came along. I mean, people stopped using that stuff. Banjo Grease is the name of this book, and our author, Dennis Must, is here with us today, and he was last night signing up in Round Rock, and there's some signed copies of the book up in Round Rock, and it's on what press?
It's Creative Arts, a company out of Berkeley, California.
Mm-hmm. And your next book, the novel, is going to be published when, do you know?
Well, it's...
Have you written it yet?
Yeah, it's virtually... It's almost done. Mm-hmm. A couple months work on it, but I don't know who the publisher will be yet. And but I suspect it'll be published in the next year or two.
We'll look forward to it. The descriptive aspect of these stories, one of the things that you do so well, I think, is describing these women that are not your traditional, you know, raving beauties, but, you know, sort of overripe. And, well, you get them. I mean, I can smell them, and they're somehow that, well, men, the lady, she's one of those.
The Bands of Grease, yes.
With her poor bunioned feet.
Yes.
Pouring out of those tight shoes and everything.
Yes.
But that other lady, now tell me, was that a true story? The older lady that living in the little bitty thing outside the big fantastic mansion, you know, that was in Pittsburgh, I think.
John, it's absolutely true.
No.
Absolutely true.
That was in the Whitey. Was that the story? What was that?
Well, no, that
it's
was
when he's more grown up, though.
Yes, that.
I just read it yesterday, so I don't remember.
I'll tell you. That's.
It's not Say Hello to
Day Labor.
Day Labor.
Day Labor. Mm-hmm. I was a day laborer, along with many other jobs in my life in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And state unemployment office, and you simply go down and hire yourself out, and you never know where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's one day, and sometimes it's a couple weeks. And I'd come off a detail of cleaning the inside of oil refinery tanks, and the clerk said, this woman is called for...
Before you go on, though, it's like even then when you're reading, you're describing cleaning those oil refinery tanks, which is part of that story. There's also a sort of an ethereal element to
almost
the experience.
Almost like you're in a cathedral of oil. Yes.
So it's a constant mixture of different emotional responses to these.
Yes, the lights coming in through the vent at the top.
Mm-hmm. And like what you were saying earlier, even though this is, all these stories take place in a pretty... really roughshod, down-home, stark sort of environment, there is plenty of room for the experience of those places to be unlimited by what we conventionally think of as being, oh, this is really a terrible, terrible situation. It's really transformed through the description. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's fine.
It's just and that anyways, one moment of looking up those you know, and seeing the light coming down.
Right. So the clerk said, will you come? And this woman normally asks for a special man, and he's not here today. And would you come? Would you go there? And I said, well, what am I to do? And he said, well, when you go, you'll find out. She'll have something for you to do. And I lived in the rougher section of this area of Pittsburgh, near the University of Pittsburgh, actually. And there's a very well-to-do section there with a lot of estates, and so I immediately knew that it was in the estate area, and a very well-known family in Pittsburgh, and I'd often passed and seen these limousines outside, antique cars being washed by chauffeurs, etc., and rang the bell, and the gentleman came, and he said, oh, I said, am I in the right place? And he said, well, it's in this area here, he said, but in that, you'll see a Quonset hut. And so here was this Quonset hut, you know, which most of your readers, I suspect, know is sort of a...
Well, pretend they don't.
Okay. I think in terms of a 1940-1950, a half circle, as it were, half moon garage. It's like you take a tin can and cut it in half and put it down in the ground and drive a car through. That's sort of what a Quonset hut with a door in the front and a door in the back. It's all aluminum. And and knocked at the door, and you come in, and it was absolutely dark in there. The only light coming from a small television set, and with an unbelievable array of...
Now you left out the detail of it was cool.
Oh, it was cool. It was
cool. You could read this part of the story. Why don't you get busy?
Okay.
That's on Day Laborer. Find the part where, now, but there are some parts in here where we can't read it, but. Let's see here. My eyes began to adjust to the darkness. That's one part. Let's see.
68, close the door.
67, 68, somewhere in there.
Okay. Yeah, I passed the wooded Hoyt estate countless times and never saw more than one residence, a huge carriage house sat alongside Columbine Road. But Edgar Hoyt stored his collection of antique Duesenbergs there. Yet there, sitting humbly under an oak tree, looking like a prefabricated World War II barrack, stood a metal Quonset hut. Alongside an awning suspended from the hut, a tattoo pole served as a makeshift garage for a decade-old Chevrolet sedan. It was one of the servants' quarters, I thought. I knocked. Come in. It was exceptionally humid that day, with no breeze. When I opened the door to 128B, a rush of refrigerated air that had been vaporized with apple-scented perfume filled my lungs. Ah, no diesel fuel, I thought. Close the door, a woman's voice snapped. But I could see no she. The interior was pitch black, except for a black and white TV screen the size of a dime novel flickering halfway down the hut. I shut the door. Sit down. But where? My eyes began to adjust to the darkness. She was to the left of me on a bed. About the hut lay an oscillating fan, a lawnmower missing one wheel, a pressure cooker, soiled plates, wine goblets, and Dixie cups on every surface. There were milk crates and roller skates, a miniature apartment washing machine with crank ringers, a Christmas tree that had turned rusty brown, jerry-rigged water pipe clothes racks draped with garments, and women's shoes. I couldn't talk but for tripping over a veritable history of shoe styles over the past two decades. The sepulchral voice spoke again, sit down. At the side of a rococo sleigh bed sat a half-upholstered Louis XV chair draped with a floral evening dress. On its seat, a gold-rimmed dinner plate and denture soaks it. Take that crap off the chair and sit down. And it continues, and essentially what I discovered is that this woman had been a dancer in New York, and
Ziegfeld Follies girl.
So the Ziegfeld Follies woman, and this man, this rich son of a rather well-known family in the town, had gone and courted her and brought her back to Pittsburgh as his woman. And but then whatever attraction, if it had ever existed between them, died, and ultimately he had her move out of the house and put her in the Quonset hut. He remained in the big estate, and I didn't quite get that until she began talking about this man, that this is my husband, and ultimately she told me the story. And she, in turn, over the years, not knowing what else to do with her life, mm-hmm. became an alcoholic. The most disturbing fact for me, and what was interesting, is that what she did, why she called day laborers, was she had a special day laborer that met her needs. And so for every two or three times a month, he would go and spend the day with her. So when I came, she said, "What the? Why did they send you?" And of course, she had been drinking at the time. There were beer bottles all over the place. There were several dogs of those little puppies in the bed with her. And she, what was sad about it was very poignant. Is that she'd be suggestive things to me. Well, do I attract you, and that? And here was this woman who was, you know, as old as I am today, and or maybe a little younger, and thought, well.
Oh, well, she didn't hold up as well as you did.
Well, no, but she said, well, then it became very clear is, well, damn it, take the upholstery off that chair. Mm-hmm. I said, but it's a fine antique. I don't care. Take it off. The old bastard. It was his. I don't like it. I don't like the way it looked. Just tear it all off. And so that's what I did. And at the end of the day, she said, your paycheck's on the stool, you know, in a little envelope, and you don't need to come tomorrow. But the most fascinating, beside the poignancy of that story, and the humor to some extent, that I had sat next to this gentleman for a number of days and knew him at that office, that day labor office. And of course, he would never ask, well, what are you doing? Well, I'm landscaping, you know, mm-hmm. trimming bushes and that.
Right. But, landscaping. Yes, oh, right. Boy, talk right. about sexual innuendo.
But this knock, this...
There's an Alberta Hunter song I can play right now. Never mind.
So...
My handyman.
Never towards, mind. Right. The handyman. So... almost towards the end of my stay there that day, the door opens and in walks this young gentleman who turned out to be the same college, small men's college that I went to in Pennsylvania, in my same grade, so I knew him, and this was his mother. And I thought, oh my God, when he walked in, and I said, does he think for a moment that I'm, you know, here, you know, like the day laborer or the handyman is, as it were. But he was so wonderful about it because he understood his mother. And he says, oh, Dennis, how nice to see you. How have you been? It was just like we met on the street. Mm-hmm. And why are you here? She says, John, well, I'm here. I'm going to go get some money from the old man. Isn't that why he's there? Mm-hmm. And so it was very brief, and that was it. So that story is pretty true.
Yeah, that sounds like they're all pretty true. That you've edited just a little bit, and pretty much you just... How do you have such a good memory is one of the questions. This is... Did you take notes while you were growing
no,
up?
No, but it is... John, it's exactly that. It's some people... I'm not cerebral in the way a lot of people are. That is one of the folks from this wonderful publicity... agents that I'm working with now visited last night, and they all came out to see me, and one of the women there was talking about her love for Henry James. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's a different kind of a mind, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a more cerebral kind of a mind,
to say the least.
Right. And it's not the way I filter in mm-hmm. information, you know.
Yours is, to me, the antithesis of Henry James.
Right, it is. It's closer to music, actually. Mm-hmm. And what happens in these stories is that somebody called them at points, some of them begin to rhapsodize. Mm-hmm. But I play jazz piano a little bit. I've taught myself
for really?
Years, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it is, it's like improvising with mm-hmm. it's what you know, and then you sort of, you know, mm-hmm. if it works, you begin to fly off,
right.
as it were.
Right. Our guest is Dennis Must. The name of the book is Banjo Grease, Selected Stories. They sounded to me in the descriptor a little different from the ordinary sort of thing, and it definitely is the case. And I've enjoyed reading them. I have a couple more I haven't read yet, but I've enjoyed every single one I've read so far. And I think you will enjoy them too, so check them out. You can find a signed copy up at Round Rock Barnes & Noble.
Yes.
And they're probably at other stores in town as well, but
yes,
for sure up there.
Or on, you know, Amazon.com or any of the internet bookstores.
I'm sorry we have to say goodbye. I'd like to hear you talk some more.
You've been great.
You're terrific.
Everybody told me you'd be wonderful.
Well, this was a really good
experience. Special for me.
Well, thank you. Likewise for me.
Thank you, sir.
So strange. I get to talk to the author of these stories, and it's such a good writer. So look forward to your novel, and when you bring that
we'll
through
be
town,
in touch again.
You come and see me.
I will.
Okay. You are listening to Eclectic Coast from KUT Austin, KUTX San Angelo. Again, our author, Dennis Must, as in you must get busy and get this book. It's called Banjo Grease.
One World Theater presents the fabulous multiphonic singers from Tibet's Drepung Losling Monastery January 19th, performing traditional temple music and mystical dances. Sponsored by Richard Gere Productions and endorsed by the Dalai Lama, this extraordinary performance sold out Carnegie Hall and the Lincoln Center. Coming soon to One World are Richie Havens January 26th and Malo featuring Jorge Santana February 3rd. For tickets, call 32 World.
Coming up on Eclecticos with John Ailey, on Wednesday, the Carolyn Herring Band plays a little bluegrass. On Thursday, Steve James celebrates Steve James Day in Austin with a few tunes. And on Friday, Hungarian gypsy group the Okros Ensemble plays live, joined by violinist Charles Castleman. That's Eclecticos with John Ailey, each weekday morning at 9, here on KUT Austin, KUTX San Angelo.
I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Joel Block for Earth and Sky, Tuesday, January 16th. The brightest planet, Venus, is easy to see in the west after sunset now. It's extremely bright in the western twilight sky. You can't miss it if you look. And it's especially easy to see Venus around now since this planet reaches what astronomers call greatest elongation today.
In other words, Venus orbits one step inward from Earth around the Sun. And today this planet reaches the end of its tether with respect to the Sun, as seen on our sky's dome. Venus is a full 47 degrees east of the Sun in this evening's western twilight sky.
And if you get clouded out this evening and can't see Venus, look again tomorrow. This planet is due to be visible in the west after sunset until late March. There's no shortage of planets to be seen around now. While Venus is in the west at nightfall, the planets Jupiter and Saturn are in the southeast. Jupiter, by the way, is also easy to see. It's the second brightest planet after sunset.
Or if you're an early riser, here's another planet you might see. The planet Mars is now at its highest in the sky in the hour before dawn. Mars is nowhere near as bright as Venus or Jupiter, but it'll be easy to see tomorrow as the closest bright object to the moon before dawn. That's our show. We have daily sky charts on our website at earthsky.com. With thanks to the National Science Foundation, we're Block and Bird for Earth and Sky.
Thank you, Deborah and Joel, again. This is KUT Austin, KUTX San Angelo, and the temperature in Austin is still 48 degrees. Hasn't changed a bit since we've been here. And the forecast is for it to remain about the same today, tonight, and tomorrow, with an 80% chance for showers today, 50 tonight and tomorrow. And for San Angelo, a lesser amount, 20% today, 30 tonight, and 30 tomorrow. Here's Bella Fleck playing the banjo. Stick around. Next, we will have the cast of Art. It's a new play opening at the Zachary Scott Theater Center starting on this Thursday. And during the noon hour, we'll be running downstairs to hear from pianist Timothy Lovelace. He's a classical artist. He'll be giving a concert this Thursday night at Jessen Auditorium. We'll hear from him live during the noon hour today. Thank you. You're listening to Eclecticos, and that was Bella Fleck from his album called Tales from the Acoustic Planet, in the piece he calls Up and Running. We played earlier John Bullard doing a gavotte, and gavotte actually was one of the words used in that story Cloth that Dennis Must read for us. Let's have another piece from this collection of classical banjo pieces. Again, our author's name we just had in Dennis Must. I really enjoyed him and really enjoyed his stories too. Banjo Grease, the name of the collection. Thank you.
Support for KUT comes from EarthShare of Texas, encouraging you to support the environment through payroll deduction. Information at earthshare-texas.org or at 800-GREEN-TX.
Again, the recording we're featuring right now is John Bullard, B-U-L-L-A-R-D, the classical banjo. Time's 11:24.
Support for KUT comes from The Cellar on Bee Caves. Informal wine tastings every Saturday, friendly service, expert advice, worldwide wine selection. 3520 Bee Caves in Westlake.
He's a political refugee from Angola with a voice of extraordinary beauty and sensitivity. Catch global pop sensation Valdemar Bastos on Thursday, January 25th at 8 p.m. in Hogg Auditorium. His music is an intoxicating cocktail of international sounds, including fado, samba, rumba, and African pop. Tickets at all UTTM ticket centers or call 477-6060 to charge. Tickets to the original show date will be honored at the door.